to the microphone to see if it'll help with the issue of feedback. So can people at Guelph hear? Are you getting feedback? Not yet. Okay. Right. Well, if you're getting feedback, please could someone let us know, because we can try and adjust the sound levels. And if you can't hear, please let us know, because then we can adjust the sound levels the other way. And hopefully we'll find a balance in between the two. Right, on that subject, that's not going to be able to happen today, but it is going to be in place by next Tuesday. So next Tuesday should be a situation where one of the screens is going to show directly the slide, and just the slide, and the other screen is actually going to be focused on the blackboards and the various lecturers walking around pointing sticks. Unfortunately, we just haven't managed to get that in place for today. I'm sorry. Also, I want to mention that the assignment set is on the website now, so you should be able to download that, and that should be due in a week on Tuesday. So if we're going to start, one question I should have asked at the end of last lecture, so I'm going to ask it now. Last lecture I was talking about interferometry and some of the kind of interference experiments that have been done. And often these have been discussed in terms of concepts like wave-particle duality. And sometimes it's a wave and sometimes it's a particle. And when we do measurements, whether it's a wave or a particle depends on what measurement we perform. So I'd like to ask a question for some feedback. And I want people to raise their hands. If you believe that, so far, you think the way to understand these experiments is that you have a whole experimental arrangement, and whether the phenomena that appears, whether you just have to explain it as being a wave or a particle, depends upon the measurement you're performing. And that fundamentally, that's the only thing you can say, is it's a wave or a particle depending on the apparatus. Could you raise your hand if you think that's the best way to think about it? No, we're just going to go through them in time. Sorry, I'm not giving you that. You're going to have to start off that way. Right now, if that's what you think, raise your hand. Okay, you've got one person. Okay, so the next option is you think that actually fundamentally these quantum objects are probably wave-like things, and the fact that sometimes we see particle-like behavior, like we look for it and we find it in any one place, well, that's some complicated thing, but maybe there's non-linearity, maybe there's something else, but really, quantum objects are waves. Raise your hand for that. Okay, one. Okay, particle behavior then is the next option. You believe really these objects are actually particles. They're definitely located in some case. And sure, we've got these complicated interference things, but actually we need to understand that complicated interference in a way of talking about motions of particles. Okay, we've got one, two, anyone in Guelph? No, okay. Fourth option, all this is rubbish. This whole talk of wave-particle duality is just really, really just a mess. Okay, that seems to be quite popular over here, and a few people in Guelph. Next option, I don't know. Don't ask me. A few people. Okay, next option, who voted more than once? A couple of people there. And finally, who didn't put your hand up at all, please put your hand up now. Okay, fair enough. Right. Well, hopefully, at least you've actually all tried to think about that a bit. On the whole, I think that the interferometry experiments and thinking about wave-particle duality, you can talk around this a lot. We're going to stop talking about that. We're going to start looking at it from a different perspective. Because it turns out, just historically, that progress was made when we actually started to concentrate on different questions. However, I'm going to talk about a couple of other things first. I'm going to say a few words. I'm going to say they're going to be some very banal and uninteresting things. The reason why I'm going to say it, because there are a couple of words that appear in the literature and people get sometimes scared by them, or people think there's something deeply philosophical about them, or there's just something not about physics. And sometimes you'll find them mentioned in textbooks in ways that's frankly just rather weird. And so I'm going to say a little bit about what interpretation or realism might be taken to mean in the context of trying to understand quantum theory. These are very abused words, so I'm going to say something very banal. I'm going to say that's what I take it to mean in the course of these lectures. I'm then going to say, well, look, what we want to do is understand quantum theory. So let's look at quantum theory, not look at some interferometry experiments that may be explained one way or another. Just try and actually give a formulation of quantum theory to focus on. And then find out that that formulation leads to a particular problem. The problem is how to understand quantum theory as a fundamental theory that describes everything. That is, this is a universal theory and everything is quantum. And this is known as the measurement problem. And then I'm going to look at some of the solutions. Only some, if we have time. Now, later on in the course, a colleague of mine by the name of Philip Goyal is going to look at some of the other approaches that one takes. So I'm going to concentrate on the ones I'm most familiar with, and he's going to concentrate on the ones he's most familiar with. So if at one point you feel that I'm being unfair, and you want to jump up and down and say, but you're being unfair on these other options, well, hopefully my colleague will be able to balance that out later. On that subject, I've also put on the website a list of books in quantum foundations, all of which are biased, and all of which are unfair. It seems to be almost impossible to write a book on this subject without being biased or unfair. And I'm no different from anybody else. So you have to take into account everything I'm saying is coming from a particular bias and perspective. We would like to do better than this. We certainly try to do better than this. But the sad fact is very frequently we fall short of that. So I'm going to try to be fair. But please remember, everything I'm saying is from a particular perspective. So, silly question. What is this equation an equation of? Someone put their hand up. We're not moving on until somebody tries. Yes. It's an electric circuit? No. Sorry, it was a trick question, of course. Okay, what this is an equation of, it's represented in displacement of a mass of L kilos that's connected to a string, to a spring. And that's in a viscous medium. And that gets us this second order differential equation. Now, actually, it's also true that exactly the same equation can also be used to represent an electric circuit. So my apologies, I set you up, of course. What was the point of this? Why? What am I actually the point I'm trying to make? Well, it's about the issue of what does this word interpretation mean? It's a word that's much maligned, but basically, I'm trying to make a point here that an uninterpreted piece of mathematics is maths. And that's all it is. It's not physics. We had an equation. That equation is just a mathematical equation. I asked a very nasty question because I set that equation up to look a particular way that looks familiar, so you think that that equation means something. But I didn't tell you what the different terms in it were supposed to correspond to. And then I said they corresponded to something that isn't natural, but actually is mathematically entirely consistent. And that's because it so happens that there is a bunch of mathematics called second-order ordinary differential equations that can apply to different physical situations. So in order to get that mathematics to apply to different physical situations, you've got to say, what is it about those terms that apply to those different physical situations? And that's the interpretation of the mathematics. And it's necessary to have some correspondence between a bunch of mathematics and the objects of our experience. First to be doing physics, first to be doing science. Why is that? Why do I say that's necessary? My go, look, well, you know, that's just some philosophy. Well, you have to make interpretation of some kind to make predictions. You have to have this correspondence to make predictions. Because when we're doing an experiment, there's an experiment that's going to make things happen. There's going to be lights flashed. There's going to be counters that are going to go click. They're going to toggle up numbers. Pointers are going, big pointers are going to go pointing to things. Here's a pointer. There's a needle on a dial and it's pointing to a number. Printers are going to printing out things. Papers are going to get written and published in journals. All as a result of doing that experiment. Certainly the last thing we hope, at least. And to actually have some correspondence to the mathematics, something in the mathematics, we've got to know what bit of that mathematics is going to be able to put into that correspondence to those things that are happening in the experiment that enable us to know what was the outcome of that experiment. Something in the mathematics has got to tell you whether or not a light is going to flash, how often it is going to flash. What number does the big pointer point to? What actually gets printed on the printer? Sometimes what gets stored on the hard drive of the computer? But you've got to have something. And at the minimum, that's the minimum level of interpretation one has to have. And you can't do without that. So you have to have some interpretation. Now, this is actually a very banal, I think, point. But some people want to run away from the word interpretation because they don't like where it leads. The next word is realism. You'll find some very funny things said about what a realism is in otherwise very good textbooks. And at the minimum, the most banal and naive thing, what realism means in this context, is we've got some mathematics. Now, we know how to use that mathematics. And we want to put some correspondence between that mathematics and at the very least the experimental outcome. But we might want to think of that as being something else as well. So to be realist about some mathematical object or some operation is just that there is a correspondence, some kind of correspondence between the mathematical object and some actual physical object. That's it. And a mathematical operation corresponds to some actual physical process. And that straight away leads to something that possibly isn't emphasized very much. There's not really such a thing as a realist or a scientific realist. There are things one is realist about and there are things one is not realist about. Now, scientific realism tends to be associated with the point of view when one tries to be realist about all the mathematical elements of one's theory. And scientific anti-realism is a situation where one tries to be realist about as little as possible and principally just those things that one directly observes. But there's always some element of this. And what has to be clear, what is one being realist about? Because there's a whole bunch of shades in between. So there's an example in classical electromagnetism. It's often felt that the electromagnetic field is something real. You can go out and you can actually measure the value of it. But there's problems with the vector potential. And there's good reasons why one thinks that maybe the vector potential is just this calculating device one uses. It's just a tool one can use to make the calculations easy, but it doesn't actually correspond to something out there in the physical world. And both scientific realists and anti-realists might be entirely happy with that. So the question is, the difference is not here, is one a realist about electromagnetism? The question is, which bit of electromagnetism is one being realist about? And one should think about that carefully, because much of the discussion in quantum mechanics is actually, what is one being realist about? What does one think it necessary to be realist about? Question. And I'm going to have another hands up. Who thinks probabilities are real? Okay, we get more people actually putting their hands up now. And who thinks probabilities are not real? Okay, who doesn't know? And who didn't put their hand up? So you don't think they're real, you don't think they're not real, you don't know. And you don't know. What do I find by real? It's there. Is there some fact of the matter in the world? But I mean, that's actually, the question of this, are probabilities real? This is actually something that's even more hotly debated and more controversial than even quantum mechanics. So again, it's a horribly trick question. There are actually two things that people often think of in terms of probabilities. And we might, again, want to concentrate on this a little because there's an object lesson in this. One thing is subjective uncertainty. And another thing is the idea of an objective chance. And a subjective uncertainty might be the following. I have a coin. And now, I've just put it under a cup, and I haven't balanced it on the edge, so it's not that much of a trick question. And the question is there a matter of fact about whether it is heads or tails? That's the first question. Who thinks there is a matter of fact about whether it's heads or tails in the actual world? Right now, is there a matter of fact about whether that coin is showing heads or face, tails up? Who thinks there is? Okay. And who thinks there isn't a matter of fact about it? Okay. Interesting. Okay, so now who thinks that the statement, there is a probability of one half that it's showing heads, is a true statement? Okay, and who held up their hand to say the probability of one half is a true statement, and also said there's a matter of fact about it showing heads? Now that's entirely consistent. There's no problem with that. But what? Because what you're thinking of there is probability as being a subjective uncertainty, by and large. Who wants to say that before I put the coin here? Okay, now I've got it in my hand, and I'm going to put it underneath the cup. Who wants to say that right now there is a matter of fact about whether it will be showing heads when I put it under the cup? Okay? And who wants to say there is no matter of fact right now about whether it will be showing heads when I put it under the cup? I promise I won't put it on its edge. Okay, now who thinks that there's a true statement? There's a probability of one half that it's going to be heads. And I'm promising I'm not going to cheat and try and do something about it. So, we've got a number of different positions you can take on this. Well, right. Anyone change their mind about whether or not there is a true fact about whether there is a probability of one half? So is there anyone who thought there is a probability of one half before I put it there, who now thinks there isn't a probability of one half? Okay. Finally. Oh, yeah.
I didn't say there is a probability of one half. Do you believe, you personally, do you believe that statement?
Given an infinite amount of trials, yes.
Ah, so there's a definition view of probability.
There's a whole bunch of different views of probability. The point I'm trying to make here is simply that there are a whole bunch of different views of probability. Some of these things might be considered to be objective facts about the world, and some of them might not. Some of them might be considered to be subjective uncertainty. We use probability in a large number of different ways. What's the probability that dinosaurs didn't exist? What's the probability that a runaway experiment in the LHC is going to suck the world into a black hole within 2 years' time? What's the probability that the Toronto Maple Leafs are going to win the next Stanley Cup? I didn't say what the probability was. Is there a probability? What's the probability that a particular atom is going to undergo radioactive decay in the next minute? Is there an objective fact in the world about that? Some people think yes, some people think no. It's heads, by the way. The question one is asking in these things is there an objective fact of the matter about the world? So, it could be when I flip the coin and say, is there a probability of one half that it's going to come up heads? And saying, is there a fact of the matter of now about the world that's determining how it's going to come out? Now, if you believe that the world is completely deterministic, then you probably do think there's a fact of the matter of now about how it's going to come. If you believe that the world is fundamentally indeterministic, then there probably isn't a fact of the matter now about how it's going to turn out. Of course, once I've flipped it, you can then say, well, there's a fact of the matter about the way it's turned out, but at the same time, I have an uncertainty about it. You can have a shift in the meaning of it, probability. You could have beforehand, there wasn't an objective fact of the matter in the world, but there was an objective fact that the probability was 1/2. But there I took probability to be an objective chance. There was something in the world that meant there was a probability of 1/2 it being heads and 1/2 it being tails, and it wasn't determined which it was going to be. Then after I flipped it, you might think, well, it really is showing heads or tails. There's a fact of the matter in that in the world, but I don't know whether it's showing heads or tails, so I have a subjective uncertainty of 1/2. And that's also a legitimate use of the word probability. And you could think that, well, actually, I don't know means there isn't a fact of the matter even in the world at all. Okay, and if you think that, do you think it now that I've looked? Now again, that's also a point of view. These are all points of view, and I'm not going to tell you any of these points of view are wrong. What I want you to do is focus on what those points of view are, what you're saying, what you're standing by. Operational quantum theory. All of this was actually just to try and clarify the mind. Hope it worked. We're now going to actually say, well, what is actually quantum theory then? And we're going to say, well, at the very minimum, we need to have this correspondence between experiments. We characterize an experiment. We do a preparation, and we do a measurement. So we have some system that we think is a quantum system, and we set up our apparatus. We have various detectors and light sources and filters and gratings, and we prepare a system to be in a state. And then we have a measurement process. We prepare the system to be in the state, and then it interacts, it evolves, and then it interacts, and then some outcomes happen. Lights go off, balloons get freed and float off into the atmosphere, party poppers are exploded. What doesn't matter is that distinct things happen. For each distinct physical setup of an apparatus, we're going to give it a label, hi. So every distinct physical way we set up a way of preparing this system, we give a label. And for every distinct way for recording the outcomes of the experiment, we give it a label J. And of course, because this isn't going to be a very boring experiment, we want to have different outcomes. So we set up a particular result set, but we have a number of outcomes for that result set. And we need another label for that. And we pretty much, this is, you know, what we need to do with any kind of experiment. I mean, this is theory independent. And at the minimum, what a theory needs to give us is the probability of getting a particular result, given we've set up our apparatus to prepare a system in a particular way and to measure the outcomes in a particular way. And that's the absolute minimum. I mean, if your theory doesn't give you that, it's not much good. Well, fortunately, quantum theory does give us that, which is useful. But there's another thing we want to find out. We find it interesting as we do these, we find that we prepare systems, and we have these different physical apparatus, but we find for every single instance of a particular outcome set, two particular physical apparatus give exactly the same set of probabilities. And when that happens, we go, well, these are pretty much equivalent then. It's different physical apparatus, but for every single possible way of checking the outcomes, these two things give the same probabilities. And we like to say, well, operationally, we're going to say we're determining that's the same state. We've prepared the same state. Mathematically, this is represented by a thing called the density matrix, which you may or may not be familiar with yet, but the simplest form of a density matrix is the wave function, which you better be familiar with. So, and we'll label that with our I. Now, a density matrix is just a statistical mixture of wave functions, more or less. And there's another kind of equivalence. We could set up two different physical ways of measuring the outcome. And we could find that for every individual way of preparing the system, that these two different ways of measuring the outcome give equivalent probabilities for the different outcomes. Now, there's a permutation in K I've got here, because obviously we could just swap two outcomes around and change the probabilities that way. But if you can permute the Ks in such a way that you get this, then you can say for every possible I, And you can say, really, these two measurement things are measuring the same thing. And the first one's saying we're preparing the same state. And if we've got this, then we're measuring the same property. Well, mathematically, the technically correct thing is a positive operator valued measure. And in the more simple way of doing things, that actually turns out to be simplified as a Hermitian operator. Or an observable, as it's usually called. And this actually has our distinct outcomes. And in this case, the Hermitian operator, we can represent the outcome by another wave function. But we'll label this by JK. And marvelously, we have that probability rule of quantum theory. Well, this seems to satisfy everything we need for interpretation, right? We've got a mathematically precise formulation. We've got our probabilities. And we know how to make these correspond to the experiment outcomes that are observed phenomena. Hands up if you think this is an interpretation. Hands up if you don't think this is an interpretation. People are really indecisive here, aren't you? Okay, well, this can sometimes be referred to as the operational interpretation of quantum theory. So there are certainly people who will regard this as being the correct way to interpret quantum theory. They refer to it as the operational interpretation of quantum theory. Now, this is a very, very simplified, I would have to say, presentation of that. It's the minimalist way of understanding quantum theory. It's just basically saying, here are the experimental operations we perform. This is how quantum theory tells us to relate the measurement and the outcome, the measurement and the preparation processes. Another thing, though, we also get is the evolution of the prepared system is linear. And that's simply if we have a prepared system in a particular state, and then we allow it to evolve, it goes into a different state, and then we test that, well, we can say that different state has, is indeed, we could prepare that state. We know these are different because we put a psi and a psi prime, and we get different outputs. And we allow the same evolution to happen on differently prepared states, we get a new differently prepared state. Well, it turns out that we have this additional property, that if we prepare this state and we allow it to evolve, we know it evolves into a state that's equivalent to this prepared state. And it's just a simple rule. But it's going to get us into an awfully interesting situation. One of the reasons why people are not happy with the operational interpretation of quantum theory, and this is connects to the quote that I had at the beginning of the lecture and that I ended the previous lecture with, is that it's all about measurements and experiments, and it's about system, and the system sits in the middle. And draw a kind of vague diagram. One starts by saying, well, we have some apparatus here, and we can build it up out of various things. We have magnets, fields, lasers, firing beams, bombs going off, some source. And this stuff we call, all parts of this we say, ah, this is the preparation process. And then, of course, what we have is we have some detectors over here. And they have little slots and boxes in them, and they're connected to things like computers, hard drives, balloons. And we say, okay, this is the measurement apparatus. And in between, we've got this thing. I'll go, well, this is the quantum state. What's that stuff? And classically, we have this thing. If we could do the same thing classically, But when we do this classically, I'm just going to move it up. When we do this classically, when we look at these things, the measurement and the preparation objects, we can describe them by the laws of classical physics. When we look at a voltmeter, we can look inside a voltmeter, and we see that the voltmeter is actually described by electromagnetism. It's described by the same laws as the electric circuit it's testing the voltage of, more or less. Because this actually turns out to be wrong. If we look really, really carefully, we find that it actually breaks down. And what happened when we found that broke down? We said, well, we need a new theory. And we came up with quantum theory. Whereas, in this thing for quantum theory, the quantum theory bit only applies to this psi bit in the middle. And it hasn't been applied to the bits outside it. The problem is, these things, these measuring devices and so forth, if we look at them, they seem to be built up out of atoms and electrons and bouncing around photons. And we have electron microscopes. We can go and we can look at them very carefully. And it looks like they themselves are also built up of quantum objects. Now, in terms of the operational formulation, the only way we can study them, the only way I can study this measuring device as a quantum object is to put it in this framework, which means I can take this object and I say, well, I'm now going to study it as a quantum object, so I now have to include that in the wave function. But that means I've now got to put another measuring device that's going to measure that object. And you go, well, but hang on, what's this measuring device? Isn't this just another collection of quantum objects? Where does it end? And you might think, well, surely this should be the same as classical physics, shouldn't it? Surely we just should be able to build up all our objects from quantum objects. We should be able to say that we describe the equipment, the chairs, the apparatus as quantum objects without having to actually put them inside other objects that aren't described as quantum objects. There should be some way in which we can actually just basically say, we've got quantum theory, this is what's happening in quantum theory, and we don't need to postulate things outside of quantum theory to understand them. And this is the particular thing that Bell was questioning, and he was saying very worried about, what happens if the system we're thinking about is the whole universe? Cosmologists have to do this all the time. What's the measuring device when the system is the whole universe? And one of the other worrying things is that, well, if you've always got to put something outside of the quantum system, are you actually just saying that classical objects, these things we are saying around, aren't described by quantum theory? If they're not described by quantum theory, then, well, what we had before is when we found out something wasn't described by classical theory, we came up with a new theory. If quantum theory breaks down and doesn't describe the actual apparatus, if we can't do it, shouldn't we look for another theory? Should we say quantum theory isn't universal? Let's look for a new theory that is. How bad of a problem is this? Well, the problem is really bad. It's called the measurement problem. So we start off and we prepare a system in a particular quantum state. And I want to emphasize, this is not just some kind of issue of worrying about interpretation, worrying about philosophical issues. I'm going to say that actually some people argue that this is actually much more serious. The measuring device is intended to tell us that it's in a particular state. So we're now going to actually arrange our preparation measurement so that we're measuring whether it's in that state. That means with certainty, with probability one, we're setting it up with probability one, if we prepare this state, then with probability one, we will get the outcome. It's in that state. And we do it while we're preparing and we want to describe our measuring device by being a quantum object two. Well, we know how to put together a quantum object, and we take this stick, we think it's full of lots of atoms, we describe each of the atoms as a quantum object, we build up a big Hilbert space for the entire stick, and we find out we get one big quantum state. We start it in some reference state, and it's just pointing up in the air. And it interacts in such a way that if we feed in, if we prepare this state psi u, and we can think of psi u as being the atom in the upper branch of the interferometer, in the upper slit. Well, what happens is this stick points here, and we can imagine there's a u. It's pointing to a u. So the big letter u at some point, and the stick is pointing to a u. And this is our phi u. This is our measuring output. But we also want something else. Starts up from zero. We also want to feed in down state. It's the atom going through the down state. Now remember, we've looked at this. We can do this experiment. We have the slits, we have the two slits, we just look where the atom is, we shine a light straight away. If it flashes by the up slit, it's in the up. If it flashes by the down, it's the down. We just collect the detection of that flash to the stick moving to point up, or the stick moving to point to a big letter D, is down. If we look at that, we can describe stick pointing up by a quantum state. In fact, we can even put that quantum state into the middle of our apparatus. And we can treat this as a quantum state, and we can observe the properties of this quantum state. And condensed matter theorists theorize about the properties of this quantum state. And the same goes for the other state. So we know that there is actually a state, a quantum state, that describes this. Pointing to U, pointing to D. There's only one problem. Our evolution is linear. So when we put in our superposition, when we prepare our superposition, what we get out is an entangled superposition, down here hiding in the corner. And we looked at this, and we looked at this a lot, and we thought it was a rather funny object. Now, I'm going to say one thing. There's an attempt, been a large number of attempts in the literature, to try and avoid this by saying, well, there's also an environment that this is interacting with. We put in an environment here, and we put in an environment here, and it goes into a different state. It goes into a different state. Well, it doesn't really help, because we've just got this. Because it's still linear, and we've still got an entangled superposition. And we looked at this state, and it was a funny, weird state. Now, there have been a large amount of attempts in the literature to understand this, and they try and, by bringing in this environment, they try and claim they've brought in irreversibility, or talking about the environment, or making marks, or amplification, or producing the records. The big process that generally gets described this is decoherence. I'm basically saying this is that decoherence is actually a very, very interesting and useful physical process, and it almost certainly does exist. And what it corresponds to is when you have a state like this, and you try and put that state into our measuring apparatus over here, but you don't have access to part of the system, you don't have access to this, then what you get out is something that looks like a mixture. But we looked at this in the interferometry. We looked at what happened when you had the entanglement between the cavities with the photons in it and the location of the particle. And if you just looked at the location of the particle on the screen, you didn't see interference. But we also found that when you went back and actually did a correlation between the particles on the screen and measurements you could perform upon the photons, you could get the interference back. So decoherence is actually a very important physical process that says in some situations you can't see that interference. But that doesn't mean it's not there. It doesn't mean it's gone. As long as it's not gone, we couldn't just simply say we've got a mixture, a statistical mix. And unfortunately, decoherence doesn't make it go away. What we have is a problem. We have a problem is that linear evolution gives us this. And we looked at this over and over again, and we said we can't understand this as just being a nice statistical mixture of half this and half that. Because there are observable consequences of half this and half that that differ from observable consequences of this. And the real big problem for that is we can do this experiment. And what do we see if we do this experiment? Well, we do the experiment and we set this up so if it points at U, if it goes through the up slit, if it points at D, if it goes through the D slit, and if we set it up to be in a superposition, what we see is half the time it points at the U and half the time it points at the D. That is what we actually see. That is the observed result. That is our raw empirical data. We do not see this. We don't know even what this is. What we see is a statistical mixture. And there are a number of points of view one can take on this. And this is where we have to say, what do we think's real? What do we mean by real? What do we understand by this? By real, I'm saying again. By real, I mean only this. That there is some part of physical reality, there is some matter of fact in the world. To say the wave function is real is to say there is the state of the wave function corresponds to some matter of fact about the state of physical objects in the world. That is what I mean by real. Yes.
Is a non-linear term in the Schrodinger equation?
Yes.
Here?
Not quite here.
Well, actually, not quite.
Okay. Well, there are people here who have looked at similar kind of ideas. I mean, is it more non-linear terms in the Schrodinger equation is one certain thing. There's actually a more general one. Basically, is the Schrodinger equation wrong? Yes. Yeah. As we've currently examined.
Well, but first, just once.
We'll get to that.
Is the wave function real?
Well, one can take a point of view that wave function is real. This is a real state of the object. I'm going to take it seriously. It represents the state of an actual physical object. We can also say that linear evolution is right. And we can also claim that, well, look, quantum mechanics gives us this. It gives us states in Hilbert space. It doesn't give us anything else. There's no other mathematical structure to quantum theory. So I'm not going to suppose there's any other structures to the physical world. But that, all that means is, that means I'm stuck in a situation. This state here is what I have to believe the state of the world is. And this state here does not distinguish between pointing that way, pointing this way. Now, I do see it pointing that way, or pointing this way. So, there's certainly some matter of fact in my experience about which way it's pointing. If there isn't a matter of fact about the world, or at least, if the state of the world is exactly symmetric between pointing this way and pointing that way. In some sense, if I see it pointing that way, there's going to be some sense in which it's also pointing that way. Both outcomes do occur. So if you want to take this point of view, you've got to believe that, and you've got to find some way of making sense of that. Some people want to do that. The next thing, you can say, well, okay, you can take the wave function to be real. Quantum theory works so well, I'm going to believe that this actually does correspond to actually a matter of fact about the world.
And I'm going to believe in the linear evolution, because we haven't found any evidence against it yet. But I'm just going to suppose there must be something more. Okay, fine, I see it pointing there. So maybe there's just more to the world. There's more to the world, and that more fact about the world is what says it's pointing over here. And that extra fact of the world could have pointed the other way, but it isn't. In this case, it's pointed this way. So that extra structure, which for historical reasons has been called hidden variables, that says, well, it's real, but there's just more to the world than that. Now, one thing I want to pay great attention to is the tense of this sentence. The hidden variables determines whether the U or D outcome has occurred. So what I'm actually saying here is just, after the fact of the measurement, there is a fact of the matter on this view about which way it's pointing. That fact of the matter is not contained in the wave function, so there must be a fact of the matter that is in addition to the wave function, and that's the hidden variable. But this is after the measurement. I have not said that the hidden variable determines in advance whether the U or D outcome will occur. So I have not assumed that these hidden variables have to determine the measurements before they happen. And this is a point that gets very often confused in the literature. A lot of the literature, a lot of the textbooks will tell you hidden variable is about adding something that tells you in advance what will occur and removes the quantum uncertainty. There certainly are hidden variable models that do that, but it isn't necessary for hidden variables. And it's not why hidden variables solve the measurement problem. It's because the hidden variable says afterwards. So you can still have things called stochastic hidden variable theories, for example. And another thing is, finally, more or less, there's no extra structure, all this extra structure exhausts what you can say if you believe the wave function is real and linear evolution is right. So there's another option, you can believe the wave function is real, that you could just say, well, look, the wave function's real, I believe that. But at the same time, I see this, or I see this. Schrodinger even says that. So that's about as clear-cut a case of an empirical falsification of a law as I've ever seen. This is what Schrodinger evolution says, this is what we see, therefore Schrodinger evolution must be empirically false. That's a claim. That's one person in the audience who at least seems to be sympathetic to. Linear evolution is just not right, so the state of the world actually is U or D. And this is referred to as objective collapse. And it says, there is a real physical process that takes place in the world that deviates from Schrodinger evolution. And at some point, the world stops being that and becomes either that or that. Now, the interesting thing about this is, in principle, it will lead to different predictions from quantum theory. Any precise formulation of this will inevitably lead to different predictions to quantum theory. Incidentally, it does not exclude the possibility that there is extra structure of the world apart from the wave function. So you might have hidden variables and objective collapse. As it turns out, for historic reasons, almost nobody ever actually explores this option of objective collapse and hidden variables. But it is there as a logical possibility. Now, given you want to solve the problem of linear Schrodinger evolution gives you this, what we see is this or this, if you believe the wave function is real, that more or less exhausts your options. Anybody want to challenge that? Anyone got a different option? The other option then is, okay, maybe the wave function isn't real. And again, I'm talking real in terms of some actual matter of fact about the world that is represented by that wave function. The wave function does not represent the state of any part of the world. Next option. Well, now we're into a bit more of a difficult situation because all quantum theory has given us is this. So now we go, well, that's not a matter of fact about the world. What is? Well, there's different points of view one can take on this as well. One can suppose that there is still a microscopic reality. There is stuff out there that's going on. It's just, it's not that. This is telling us something about how that microscopic reality is behaving, but the microscopic reality is not that. The astute might notice this is actually another variation on hidden variables. It says there's extra structure to the world that we don't know about it above and beyond the wave function. Another.
Like an underlying theory, sort of theory of everything type approach. That quantum theory is only described in a certain portion. And that there's even like hidden variables theories or say a whole new theory to supersede.
There is always the option of quantum theory is wrong.
Yeah.
So and that actually this is actually almost quantum theory is wrong. But yeah.
Can this also give us that though? That there's a microscopic reality?
There is no it's not clear yet. Whether this would be. There's a different attitude one can take to that, and I'm going to say shortly. There's another option is there is no microscopic reality. Now, I mentioned this option. Only the macroscopic world is real. How does this work? It says that these things like the apparatus exist. These things we have here, the measuring apparatus, they exist and they're real.
They're not actually modelled in our theory. We don't actually have objects in our theory that describe them. But what happens is we find when we get this very, very sensitive interactions between them, the normal classical description we had stops working, and they start behaving differently. And there's a phrase that was used to describe this, which is non-classically describable functioning of classically describable experimental apparatus. And that was Niels Bohr, who was one of the founders of quantum theory. He said, that's how you understand quantum theory. It's tricky. Bohr was actually a little shifty on whether or not he believed that microscopic reality existed or not. It has some, if you want to actually really push that, it has some rather interesting implications. Is the LHC at CERN going to search for the Higgs boson? Well, the Higgs boson doesn't exist. The Higgs boson is just a term in an equation that describes how 23-kilometer-wide rings operate. Now, you might have a job selling that to a government. And finally, and I think this does more or less, assuming that quantum theory is not going to be replaced by another theory, the last option is there's no microscopic reality and there's no macroscopic reality either. And I think that pretty much exhausts the logical options, other than quantum theory is wrong. Yes?
Is there a way to this topic fit in? Like, where's the line?
There is an ambiguity. What is macroscopic and what is microscopic? Indeed.
Okay. So would it be like phasing from one to the other, or is it a hard line, or what's the general consensus of that opinion?
There is none.
Okay.
How about Schrodinger's cat, where there are two realities that exist, the one that we see and the one that could exist in another universe?
I'm not quite sure. One possibility when you say another universe, I mean, you might be referring to this both happens to occur.
Right, so if there are two realities at the same time.
What do you mean two realities?
It's if we pick our own reality, not.
We pick our own reality.
In a sense that both of them occur at the same time, yet we only see the one that we want to see.
I mean, is it? Okay. I'm resisting the temptation to try and pick on you for imprecise use of language. The beginning of the course, I put in the slide, I put clarity and precision. And this is the kind of thing which, when we say we want to pick, do we want to pick whether it points up or down? I mean, I see it pointing up or I see it pointing down. Do I actually have a want to see it up or want to see it down? There is the fact that I actually see it up or down. Now, if we can set this up as a Schrodinger's cat experiment, so this is Schrodinger's cat, and this is alive and this is dead. And I can open a box and I can see whether it's alive or I can see whether it's dead. But there's a sense in which I don't want. I mean, probably I, unless I don't like the cat.
But then it exists at the same time as the one and the other.
Well, the two things could exist, both outcomes could occur. That's up there, that's an option. And when you say there are two realities, isn't that just another way of saying both outcomes occur? Okay, well, just to give some of the kind of ways which these are actually being presented. These are actually points of view that have been described as being realist points of view, because these are points of view that says there's some fact of the matter about the world, and that fact of the matter has a mathematical representation. And these are points of views that have been described as being anti-realist. Now, there's some overlap here. The overlap being a large amount because in this particular option here, is the question of the attitude of you saying, well, there are these hidden variables, but do I want to develop a mathematical theory of it? So there are some people who take this position but believe in principle one cannot or should not attempt to actually figure out what they are, those hidden variables are, or develop a theory of it. And in terms of who... Now, this is an incredibly biased positioning. This is my own take on where people might have been considered to be put. You'll find some people actually appear in more than one place. And whether that's a superposition or a mixture, or it's just because they're actually sometimes kind of vague and ambiguous in their writing, or in some cases because they change their mind. And it's hard to say. Some of the people, for example, have said, well, when does things happen? Well, when it enters consciousness. This guy. Interestingly, Einstein and Bohr is actually not too far apart, although they're famously supposed to have disagreed. These guys are the ones that are kind of being considered to be the heretics that have taken unorthodox positions. This also is kind of seen as something of an unorthodox position, but nowadays is approaching being a very orthodox position. So, I'm going to try to actually have a look now. I have difficulty describing some of these positions. I'm going to say straight up, I've worked on these kind of theories. So I'm going to talk about some of these kind of theories. Next week, I will get a bit more broader. And I believe that my colleague is going to talk about more some of these kind of theories. I don't know if anyone's actually going to talk about these kind of theories. It's a logically consistent position one can take. So, option one I'm going to consider is wave function's real, does represent the state? Yes?
In the class, whether we thought probabilities were real or not.
Right.
So, if we thought probabilities weren't real, could we then say that the wave function doesn't represent anything real, but it just gives us probabilities?
If you think probabilities are real.
Aren't
real. You can say that. So that puts you in the wave function isn't real. Yeah. Right. It does give you probabilities. Probabilities of what?
Surveys of
outcomes of, say, macroscopic stuff.
Now,
but you could also believe that they're giving you probabilities of what's going on in microscopic stuff. Or you could believe it's, I don't know.
You could also think it's sort of like an invariable idea. You don't necessarily believe in probabilities, but it's sort of the idea that the wave function carries sort of a coding. And then you kind of get, you could go to either of the hidden variable ideas, really.
Well,
like you could say that it's probabilities aren't necessarily real, but it's holding all this information, and you just can't necessarily get to it that way.
Probabilities aren't real, but the wave, I mean, you believe the wave function is real.
What I'm saying is that you might be able to believe the wave function is real and the probabilities aren't real.
Yeah, you believe the wave function is real and probabilities aren't.
Yeah, that's kind of.
You were saying wave function is not real and probabilities aren't real.
That's what I was saying.
I mean, these are all positions that you can take. I'm not going to tell you you can't take these positions. Yes, you can. Take these positions. By and large, you're going to find, if you really, really push what you mean, you're going to be taking one of these positions.
Yes. Whose interpretations are you going to be going over later in your lectures? Who in particular are you going to center on? Whose particular side are you on of all the scientists that you listed up there?
Oh!
Bone?
You kind of work it out then.
Yeah. Bone?
Them guys. The ones in red. Mm-hmm.
But any in particular are you going to center on in the next few lectures? That's all.
Them guys. So, actually, in the next lecture, I'm going to be talking about non-locality, but what I don't talk about in this lecture, I'm going to talk about in the final lectures. And we're certainly not going to get through all I want to talk about in this lecture. But we'll go through them. I'm just going to actually...
In this, the idea is I'm going to start by giving a summary of some of the principal realist approaches, wave function realist approaches. And we'll see how far we get. So the first option we had was this. Wave function is real, does represent the state of a physical object. Linear illusion is right, there's no extra structure to the world. That is a representation of the world. If there's no extra structure to the world, then there must be both outcomes occurring. But if one's occurred, the other must have occurred. Otherwise, if one's occurred and the other hasn't occurred, then there's some extra structure to the world. There's some extra matter of fact that isn't in the wave function. Both outcomes do occur. And this is called many worlds, for obvious reasons. Now, it's actually quite... It's a lot harder than that to make it work, however. It has some problems. And these, the two problems I'm going to briefly mention, because I want you to think about what does this mean. How does the actual mathematics of states in Hilbert space actually correspond to this semantics of many worlds? We have Hilbert spaces, which is this linear space in which our wave functions live. The Hilbert space doesn't prefer any particular set of wave functions. And that's going to be a problem for us. Because we have this wave function, and we want this wave function, we want many worlds to explain the fact that what we see is that, all that, without there actually being a preference in the world for it. But we also saw that we can construct these states. And we can rewrite the wave function. And here's the thing. This wave function and this wave function are one and exactly the same wave function. They're not different. They are the same. And if this is the state of the world, then this is the state of the world. And we see that. And we don't see that. Why? And this is actually quite a serious problem if you stop back and think that. Because the whole point of we're seeing this, we're trying to explain we see this, And we're trying to explain we see this by supposing that, well, there's this world and there's this world, because this is the state of the world. But if this is the state of the world, this is the state of the world. And what's the reason why we don't see this? Why aren't we seeing this or this? It seems to be something about the way we perceive the world that prefers some kind of states to other kinds of states. And it's not captured in this. Yes?
Well, maybe it's just my naive, but you never really measure the state, you measure a number, right? So if you're measuring the plus minus basis here, you pick out a number and you do see that. And if you're measuring the up down basis, you pick out a number and you do see that. Like one or the other of many worlds, okay, another world, measure the other one, okay. But you see a number, right?
Well, what I'm saying is this U.
Yeah.
This U is this, pointing to the letter U. Do you see this pointing? And this D is this pointing over here. Do you see this pointing? So that's what I'm saying.
But that's entirely measuring up-down basis, and it's measuring
What I'm trying to say is, we're going from many worlds' point of view,
We're
going from the point of view that this actually does correspond to the state of the world, but this corresponds to the point of view, and that's what we see. So if you want to see the number, it's where the number is pointing to. But that would be the physical object being in the state of displaying the number that you see. And that's the physical object being in the state of displaying the other number that you see. We try and talk about pointers because often pointers are actually quite easy to visualize. Usually it's actually numbers, but what we like is, as long as these are distinct things and we see these distinct things, it doesn't help us because the wave function doesn't tell us that we're seeing these and not these. Not so far, at least.
Thank you.
I am having to simplify everything of this. I could spend four lectures talking about any one of these in separate sections. So I apologize for the simplifications. The problem has a number of attempts to solve it. There's what's called the many worlds interpretation, or might have called the old many worlds interpretation. And this has been associated with, nobody actually knows what Everett himself, who is the originator of many worlds interpretation, nobody's really sure what he actually believed. You can read his papers and people have understood it different ways. What he referred to as relative states, and there's an entire literature just discussing what a relative state means. But two people in the 60s, Bryce DeWitt and Neil Graham, attempted to develop this and really coined the term many worlds. And a guy called David Deutsch in the 90s defended this position quite strongly. And this, now none of these people would agree with what I'm about to say. But at the same time, there is a kind of consensus that in effect this is what they had actually done, implicitly. They talked about the universe branching, and they assumed the universe branches in a particular way. And that assumption that it branches this way and not this way is implicitly putting extra structure into the universe, that there is actually a process of branching, and that process of branching is a real physical process and it prefers one basis to another. But that is more structured than things in the wave function and the Schrödinger evolution. Now that's the extra structure that determines the branch, the basis in which the extra events occur. So the whole point of the many worlds interpretation was not to add extra structure. Which is why nowadays this isn't right anymore. Now there's the new Emeretian interpretation. And they try to avoid even the phrase many worlds and refer to them as ever afterwards. And Benny Dutch is on that, he's having changed his mind. Although he might not agree.
And two people, two very ferociously intelligent people by the name of Simon Saunders and David Wallace, have spent a lot of work on actually explaining this. And the key first thing they want to understand is that microscopic branching as such does not occur. There is no such process as branching. They want to be absolutely strict and rigorous. The only thing that's real is Schrödinger evolution and the wave function, and there's nothing in Schrödinger evolution and the wave function that corresponds to branching. Therefore, branching isn't real. It doesn't occur. There is no such thing as microscopic branching, which goes against what you might take as the intuitive sense and what the populist description of many worlds actually constitutes. Now, decoherence plays a large role in what they're talking about. But it's about simply defining macroscopic objects. Objects are macroscopic when they decohere. They need macroscopic objects because they want to describe us as macroscopic objects. We perceive this rather than this because, well, they want to put this us now. So they want this to be me seeing it pointing at you. And they want this to be me seeing it pointing at D. So we put ourselves into it. I put myself into the wave function, which is fine. That's what you would want to do if quantum theory is universal. And they say, well, look, because that is an emergent state that is me perceiving you, and that is an emergent state of me perceiving D. And every time I'm actually in a situation where I'm perceiving these things, I'm a macroscopic decoherent thing. So I certainly can't interact between my two different selves, one perceiving you and one perceiving D, because decoherence prevents that. But the key thing here is, it's my perception which is divided. It isn't the universe that is split into two different branches. And I want to make this point because this is what the new Everett interpretation actually is trying to say. On pain of avoiding the charge that they've added extra structure. It has another problem. And that problem is generates an enormous amount of controversy. And it's about the role of understanding probability, which, as we've seen already today, is a tricky term in itself. Suppose we prepare a quantum coin, and you prepare it into this not symmetric wave function. Now, we know that the probability, if we do this as a normal kind of quantum measurement, we get probability of 3/4 of heads and 1/4 of tails. So you're trying to con me, obviously, but, you know, it could be done. You've got a biased coin. Eventually, I actually will be able to tell you've got a biased coin. But if I'm a many-worlder, if I'm an Everettian, what I know is going to happen is, in future, if I find out whether the coin's doing heads or tails, I divide, and there's going to be one future self of me seeing heads and one future self of me seeing tails. And now you prepare another coin. This is a more even, fair coin. If I'm going to actually look at that coin, I become an entangled superposition of this, and there's going to be a future me seeing heads, and there's going to be a future me seeing tails. And now this is going to happen. So when I look at the coin, then I actually end up finding myself seeing heads or seeing tails. But I also believe there's another one of me in a different branch, if you like. There's a different divided perception seeing the other one. What's the problem here? The problem is, these two things say exactly the same thing. The values of this doesn't seem to have entered into what I'm seeing. There's not a sense in which I think there's a greater likelihood that in this case I'm going to see myself seeing heads than in this case. I know in both cases there's going to be a future me seeing heads and a future me seeing tails. Yes? Sure, yeah. Okay, I would say that an Everettian would not say that it requires a conscious observer, but rather we as conscious observers need, the theory requires to be able to find a place for us as conscious observers within it. So the description of the world as this wave function evolving, that is taken to be the description of the world as the wave function evolving, and that's the real physical fact about the world, regardless of whether there should be anyone in the world observing it, whether they're conscious or not, or whether that's important. However, because you want this to be a universal theory, what they want is there to be structures in that wave function that we can see represent us. So that means that when we as conscious observers in the wave function, in the look in that wave function, what we see is there are structures there, and those structures, the experiences of those structures, correspond to our experiences in a way that we can identify that and say, well, this theory is a good theory, and this theory describes the world the way we see it. Does that help answer your question, or...? Okay, thank you. Yes?
If I take the bias run and keep on flipping it and take measurements, 3/4 of the time I measure heads and 1/4 I measure tails.
Hang on. If understanding quantum theory, and a normal measurement quantum theory, if I take a bias coin and I flip 1,000 times, then I have an expectation that in about 750 of them it's gone heads. That's right, yes.
Okay. So now we're also saying there's another world where when we are measuring heads, the other world's measuring tails. So the other world's expecting 3/4 tails and 1/4 heads, so
there's not any expectancy. Eberetti has no expectancy of heads and tails in that sense. What they know is going to happen is there's going to be someone seeing heads and there's going to be someone seeing tails.
The obvious question is, why aren't there three future ones of you seeing heads and one of you?
One other thing, yes. One suggestion you might want to do is you suppose that there's actually a splitting that it breaks into, say, three universes going that way and one universe going this way.
But I thought Eberettians don't see the splitting.
Exactly. There is no branching as a physical process. If you had branching as a physical process, then you could actually add a number to that process and say, well, it splits into 750 universes that way, but 150 this way. And because the modern Eberettian doesn't believe that branching is a physical process, that isn't an option to them. They've just got a world, and in that world, there's one perception branch, let's say, in which you're seeing heads, and one perception branch in which you're seeing tails. And sure, there's this complex value attached to each of those branches, but it doesn't correspond to any kind of counting. If you have, in the extreme cases, you prepare 1,000 coins, and now you don't tell, I don't know what that is. And I look at those 1,000 coins, as an Eberettian, I see, there's a futurist me seeing each and every possible combination of heads and tails. And that's going to be the case regardless of the values of alpha and beta. Now normally, under the normal kind of perception of saying, if we had this, if I saw 750 times coming up heads, I'd say my best guess is that alpha is up about √3/2. Because when I square that I get 3/4. But as an Eberettian, how do I understand that? As an Eberettian, I find myself on a branch which is 750 heads. Well, I know that's going to happen regardless of what the alpha and beta was. Just as I know regardless of what the alpha and beta was, there's another me that's seeing it with 50-50. There's another me seeing it 25-75 the other way.
There is a resolution. People like David Deutsch and David Wallace, whose name I mentioned earlier, they put a lot of work into trying to actually resolve this. And they say it's all about gambling. It's about flipping coins and it's about placing bets. And it's about, and they have an argument that they claim that the only rational way you can behave if you are in an Eberettian universe, when someone's presenting you with these coin flips and asking you to bet on outcomes, that ultimately what probability is really all about is about how much you're prepared to bet on different things happening. And that the only way you can actually rationally bet when faced with these possibilities is to bet as if you lived in a world in which these things happen truly randomly with probability equal to this. And they have a very long and very sophisticated and very deep mathematical argument for it. But it is controversial, because there are also a number of people who believe that this fundamentally doesn't work. So at this point, we're actually talking about something that is actually the cutting edge of current research. And I'm not going to give you any opinion on what I think of it. Okay, well, we're not going to get very far in the next option, but we'll start with it, unless we have further questions on that. Okay. Next option, wave function is real, does represent the states of the physical object, linear evolution is right, but you might go, well, look, you know, there's got to be something more to the universe then. And that leads you onto the option of hidden variables. Called hidden because of a 1952 tape paper, which actually put them in quotes. They were quoted as being hidden, but the name stuck. Well, the most famous, there are many possibilities for hidden variable theories, but there is one that has been particularly well developed, and I'm going to introduce that. And this is actually quantum theory, arguably, in that this is actually the theory that de Broglie worked out in the 1920s and was presented at the Solvay conference and didn't become orthodoxy. It was picked up again in the 1950s by a guy by the name of David Bohm. And it's sometimes called de Broglie-Bohm theory, and some people nowadays call it Bohmian mechanics. It also is called pilot wave theory as well. And it was classed by John Stuart Bell as answering the question in the wave particle duality things as answering the question wave or particle with the answer wave and particle as just being the most obvious and natural way to understand interferometry experiments. Simply that this, there is a particle, it goes through one slit. That's why when you look for it, you find it in one slit or the other, because there's a particle and it goes through one slit, and that's what particles do. There's also a wave, and the wave goes through both slits, and the wave guides both the particle. And the wave has interference, because that's what waves do. So when you see the interference, you're seeing the effect of waves, and when you see the particle, you're seeing the particle, and there's both of them. And I'm actually going to show you the pictures of how that works. The mechanics of how this works is you take what's called the polar decomposition of the wave function, and we notice that, well, for a plane wave, it's very simple. And if we take momentum h bar k, and this is the old de Broglie relationship from which quantum mechanics was founded, we find it's h bar times the gradient of that phase, because the phase is kx. And de Broglie constructed quantum mechanics on this basis. But what he suggested was, well, let's actually suppose this p here really is the momentum, the classical momentum of the particle. So what he's suggesting is there is actually a real physical object, S. So this is a field so that every point in space, there is a value to this. And it's the phase of actually a complex value field. And at every point in space, there is a value of this. There is also a particle. The particle is at a particular point in space. The velocity of the particle depends on the gradient of the value of the field at that particular point in space. And this gets referred to as the guidance condition, because the idea is there's a wave here, and the wave is guiding the motion of the particle. And also, in order to make this work, you have to suppose that, well, there's some probability that the particle initially, at some time, is at some particular point P. So there's some, now, this is definitely a subjective uncertainty probability. And that probability is equal to the mod squared of the wave function, which is just the Born rule. And one of the things is there's well known, and this is standard quantum theory, there is a conservation of probability equation that you can get from Schrödinger equation. And if you actually do the calculation, you find that it comes out as being this is the probability current, and this is the flow of probability. Well, it's got this grad S in here, and you put that, and you get the X dot. And what this says is that the velocity of the particle goes in here. You've got a P X dot, and if you write that out, it looks like that. And this should be a recognizable equation to many people. It's taught as a second year applied maths course. I know because I taught it last year. And this has the following property. That if you, these V's, if you integrate along these trajectories, these positions, these velocities, you get them to be the flow lines of the conserved probability current. So, They have some region of space. And we've got, at each point, say, some point x, there's actually a value to this space. But there's also a gradient to it. So the gradient of that function at that point gives us the velocity of the particle if the particle is at that point. So it moves on a little bit, it steps on, and it finds itself at a new place. That has a new gradient, a new velocity, so its velocity has changed slightly. So we move on for that step, and we integrate that, and we get a trajectory for the particle. If we look at the ensemble of all those trajectories, these are the flow lines of the probability current. Being the flow lines of the probability current means very nice property. Means that if any one time this ensemble of trajectories are distributed with the probability, then they are distributed with that probability at every other time as well. Because they're just following the probability flow. And that means that if at one point these particles are distributed with the probabilities given by quantum theory, then at every other point in time, they are distributed with the probabilities given by quantum theory. And that's a theorem, I think. Well, yes.
Path, right? For every, you said for every time, but would it just be for every time along that path?
Okay, let's think of it this way. I'm going to get a diagram of this. Suppose we have two slits. So we pick a point in time. We have a probability distribution. And we suppose the particle is going to be at this along this line at this point in time. It's just removed form, just for simplicity. And it's just a little bit after the slits. Now, there's a whole bunch of trajectories. Each point in here, we've got a trajectory going through it. Each point on here, we've got a trajectory going through it. And they might do all sorts of different things. We don't know yet, but we haven't solved them. But each point goes up and does some trajectory. These trajectories are wrong, by the way, don't take them seriously. But that's because I'm not going to beg the question of what they are yet. Now, if we suppose that the probability at this point in time of the particle being on this trajectory is given by the Born, then we advance the probabilities to a bit later in time, or we advance the trajectories to a bit later in time. We draw another line, and we suppose, okay, what's the probability now? Well, we find that if we say that the probability of being on this set of trajectories, we advance them forward, and we say, well, now for me that same probability of finding them there, because the probability kind of changed what trajectory they're on. So if we now look at this new set of trajectories, we look at what the distribution of probability is given this new set of trajectories at this new point in time, and we find it's equal to the mod squared of the wave function at the new point in time. And this follows from the fact that this guidance condition is basically using the conservation of probability equation that we get in quantum theory. Well, if we take a quick look, we've just got time. Suppose we actually say, that's all very well for this, but now we've got our superposition of our up and down states. Well, if we want to understand the superposition of the up and down states, we still have to have this polar decomposition of the overall wave function. What does that look like? This actually should be familiar, because we did look at it on Tuesday.
So this is just our psi squared. But another thing we're going to need is we're going to need the phase of the combined wave function. This is horrible. It's a really ugly thing. I mean, it's got an inverse tangent there, for God's sake. Who on earth wants to use that? But it can be defined. It's a well-defined mathematical function. Fortunately, there are some ways in which that simplifies. If we actually act some position, and we suppose that the particle is located at some position. If it turns out that's a position such that one or other of these wave packets has a zero probability attached to it. So we've got the wave packet at one region of space. but it's usually located in just a confined region. The particle's somewhere else, somewhere where the wave packet is zero. Then what happens? Well, let's suppose we take u equals zero. Well, that's zero, so that whole term disappears. That's zero, so we're left with that. And that's zero, and that's zero, so that term disappears, and that term disappears. So we've got these two. That cancels out with that. We've got sine over cos, which is a tangent, and we take the inverse tangent, and that's nice. What we find is, actually, there may be a factor of root 2 messing up there. I have to check that one. But that's only in the magnitude. The phase is definitely that, and the phase is what directs the motion of the particle. So what that says is, oh, this is you. Suppose we're in the particle is in a region of space where this wave factor is effectively zero. Then, despite the fact it's in a superposition, it's going to behave, its trajectory is going to behave as if the state is just this one. And, of course, if it's in the other region of space, then it will behave as if the wave factor is just the other one. And here we see the two-slit experiment. So here we have the two wave packets, the up and the down. Now they're quite clearly very separate. And what happens is the particles are just not showing any kind of interference. And as they spread out and diffuse, the wave packets start to overlap. As they start to overlap, well, now we can't treat them as being in two separate wave packets. And the phase becomes very complicated. It's this arctan expression. It's very horrible. But if you do actually plug it into a computer, and you try and calculate it out, you find that what happens is it guides the particle away from certain regions. So as soon as the particle moves into a certain region, it quickly sweeps it off out of that region again. Instead, guides it into certain regions. It particularly gets concentrated around here, and it voids there. And why does it get concentrated around here and avoid here? Because the wave, which went through both slits, is telling it to avoid there. If I look for the particle, I find it there, or I find it there, on one of those trajectories, or the other. If I look for the interference, the wave guides it to avoid the nodes, and guides it to arrive at the current beats. And if I put a phase shifter, it shifts. Did anyone catch that? Pay close attention to the middle bit. And these are actual calculations of what happens in the two-slit experiment. So if you add a phase shift, it shifts up. How does the particle know? Because the wave knows, and the wave tells the particle. And Bell did one point say, this is really probably the most simple way of understanding interferometry experiments. However, there are a lot of other problems for the hidden variable theories. And unfortunately, we're not going to have time to go into them. So we will, on next Tuesday, we're going to talk about non-locality, but I will come back to this and other models on the Thursday following. Oh, hang on. Yes, question. Yes. No. The reason is because the question of what I post depends on what I'm actually going to end up saying. So I'm afraid I'm going to post the notes after class.
On the other screen that they have, they can see themselves.
Trust me, I was here last week and listened to you in Florida.